Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
My name's Nicole. I haven't done public speaking since I was like 18, so I wrote everything out, so bear with me here. I'm a nurse at Memorial in the PACU, and that stands for the Post-Anesthesia Care Unit. I'm the person who's with people as they wake up from surgery, giving them pain medicine and whatever else they need, keeping them just till they're stable and then sending them on to the next destination. It's a pretty satisfying job most days because the problems are usually concrete. If something goes wrong, it goes wrong fast, and we fix it fast. If my patient stops breathing, I can holler and have six other people with me at the bedside within seconds. If someone's blood pressure drops to 60 over 40, or their pain shoots up to 10 out of 10, I have a whole arsenal of IV medications and other interventions that work usually within a few minutes to start stabilizing the problem. The saying we have at the hospital is that the PACU is the place where ICU nurses go to die. Because nurses burnt out from their jobs on the critical care floors often come down. It's got just enough action to keep life interesting, but very little of the intense, exhausting hardship of the floor. So once a nurse comes down to us, then they never return to the lands up above. Until this past year, that is. Because COVID, of course, changed everything in the hospital and everywhere else. During the winter surge, from late October until early January, all of the elective surgeries stopped. So if waiting for your surgery wasn't going to kill you or cause loss of a major organ system, then it just didn't happen. The hospital was overflowing with COVID patients. We were out of beds and out of nurses to adequately care for the people in those beds. UC Health is a great organization, and they found creative ways to get the supplies they needed. So we never found ourselves wearing trash bags as isolation gowns like the poor folks in New York City. But there were definitely some suboptimal substitutions. The halt in surgeries was meant to decrease infection exposure to patients, as well as free up beds, staff, and supplies. Since I'd left the cardiac floor just a few years prior, I did a quick brush up on changes in the charting system, and then found myself a temporary new home on the high acuity floor. So that's a step-down unit for patients not quite sick enough to be in the ICU. This turned out to be a bit of an adventure since the definition of not sick enough for the ICU got stretched really far during those months. Our 10-bed ICU up there had 14-bed patients my first day back on the floor. They had to borrow four rooms from the high acuity floor to fit everyone in and jerry-rigging iPads as portable monitoring stations. They were so intensely full and their staff was stretched so thin that if you weren't intubated and on a ventilator, then you weren't in the ICU. You were with me on the high acuity floor. So some of the patients I took care of during those days were really intensely ill and would normally have been ICU patients were it not for the situation. Some of them were on BiPAP, which is a machine that blows oxygen really forcefully through a mask, kind of like that high winds tunnel at the zoo near the African zebra where you put the kids in with the quarters and then see them go like, ah, as the wind blows up their face. It's one of those kinds of masks. Others were on high flow oxygen at 50 or 60 liters per minute. So for reference, historically, anybody who needs more than 5 or 6 liters of oxygen for more than a few hours is unstable enough to be ICU bound, to be cared for by a nurse that has maybe 2 patients. But here they were on 60 liters with me. And I had 4 patients, most of which required time-intensive costume changes every time I entered and exited their rooms. And of course, none of them had family members with them to help them with the little things and to comfort them. So it felt like a pretty wild circus ride. I've been a nurse for over 12 years, so I'm used to seeing people suffer and even seeing people die. But the intensity of suffering during those days weighed on me heavily. I think they weighed on everyone there heavily. I don't really have words to describe the way I felt some days coming home from work. We all go into our professions in healthcare hoping to make a difference, to alleviate suffering and to bring healing. But the healing was hard to see for many of those very sick COVID patients. One good friend who's an ICU nurse told me one day at lunch she'd come down with significant PTSD symptoms and wasn't sure she could go on. She said that during her 8 years of ICU nursing, she'd always been able to push through. But after months of having every single patient die, she was losing her ability to cope. On the high acuity floor, things were less dire, but we had many deaths as well. More difficult than the deaths themselves was dealing with the separation of family members. Anxious wives and adult children would call me, desperate for good news about their loved ones, and I didn't always feel like I had honest words of comfort to give them. I would promise a daughter that I would hang up the photos she had sent in of her 1-year-old daughter's birthday. Then I'd go in and try to get her father excited to see the photos of his granddaughter and interested in where they should be hung in his room. But the grandfather would be too exhausted, working too hard to just breathe, to even really respond. There's really no substitute for the loving presence of family, but we had to try to communicate the love of family members somehow, some way, through our giant yellow shower curtain gowns and our respirators that looked like gas masks. Some days I wondered if my efforts made any difference at all, and what the point of all this human suffering was. During this time, the song "Nothing is Lost on the Breath of God" became a frequent refrain on my car ride home. Sometimes it was easy to feel like I could be God's hands at work, even if the work itself was emotionally fraught. A significant number of extremely ill COVID patients decided, when the time came, that they didn't want to be put on the ventilator. So the palliative care folks would come in, make sure they were sure about their decision, and then write orders for us to give them a bunch of morphine and Versed to ease their discomfort, and then we'd wean them off their oxygen. These patients were so heavily dependent on these super high levels of oxygen that it didn't take them long to pass once it was removed. One day, a woman chose this on my shift. She was a Christian, and she was ready to join her husband in heaven. She had no more close family and didn't want any friends to come be with her. So I sat with her and listened as she talked about her beloved dogs, showed me pictures of them, took a few final sips of Diet Coke, and then set down her iPad for the last time and said, "I'm ready." This type of passing is hard, but it has its own sort of beauty, and there's an ability to praise God for the fact that she's exactly where she wanted to be, even as you wrap a tag around her big toe and put her earthly shell into a bag. One of my greatest struggles in nursing, in life really, has been the desire to avoid suffering. Whether this is part of my Enneagram 7 personality or just a basic part of human existence, I don't know. But I'd really rather leave the sitting with suffering to my therapist husband over there and go watch a happy movie while he deals with it. God forced my hand when I became a nurse. I remember the day, 10 years or so ago, that God really began to work his way into me and teach me how to be present in suffering and pain without being angry that he wasn't fixing it. I had a patient that day, a wonderful, vibrant, full of life, God-fearing man of about 70 years old. He had just received a fatal lung cancer diagnosis. His death was imminent because the cancer was really aggressive. His room was full of friends, and they laughed and spoke gaily about the joys that God had given him while he was on earth. But I drove home that night angry. I was angry at God that good people die and the world is not fair. And I couldn't help but wonder, why am I more upset that this man is dying than he is? My moment of revelation came as I remembered a story from the book The Hiding Place, written by Corrie ten Boom about her life in Nazi Germany. She said when she was a child, she encountered death for the first time and became distraught that her own daddy might die. So I'll read a little bit of what happens next. Father sat down on the edge of the narrow bed. "Corrie," he began gently, "when you and I go to Amsterdam, when do I give you your ticket?" I sniffled a few times, considering this. "Why, just before we get on the train." "Exactly. And our wise Father in heaven knows when we're going to need things too. Don't run out ahead of him, Corrie. When the time comes that some of us will have to die, you will look into your heart and find the strength you need, just in time." Through Corrie's brief memory, God reminded me that everyone has their own story, and he meets them in it. Like Aslan says in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, no one gets to know all of anyone's story except their own. So often in nursing, and especially over the winter months this past year, I've seen people in moments that seem too hard to bear. But I remind myself over and over again that I'm only seeing a glimpse of their story, and that God has more for them that I cannot possibly see or understand as I walk beside them in this dark night of their soul. God is a God who mourns with those who mourn, but he's also a God who restores our souls. These pieces I see are not the end of the story, and I don't have to see the end of every story to know that God is good, that he is faithful, and that he is there even when I do not see him. I may only hear the screams of agony of a wife who found out by phone that her husband passed away from COVID overnight, and she missed the phone call, and it's too late. But God knows her story. He loves her, and he has the power to heal and bring beauty out of ashes. If I turn away from these moments of suffering, I lose my opportunity to play some small part in the beautiful tapestry that God is weaving. The threads don't have to understand the pattern if they have faith in the skill of the weaver and are willing to submit to his design. This isn't an easy lesson for me. It's one that I have to relearn over and over again. And even though it's never been a lesson I enjoy, I'm grateful that he's such a patient teacher. I may never stop dreading the opportunity to enter into suffering. The day you see me come up here and say I've become a pediatric oncology nurse is the day you'll know I've conquered it once and for all, right? But I'm so grateful for the God who's teaching and has taught me to sit with and mourn with those who mourn, along with them without despairing, knowing that he is weaving their story with beauty, and the moment of darkness in which I sit with them today is not the end of their story.
Thank you for sharing, Nicole. You're kind of a tough act to follow. I, too, typed mine out because I don't do much public speaking. When I mentioned to my husband, Nathan, that I was asked to speak today, I told him I absolutely wasn't going to do it. I really didn't have anything to share, I said to him. But the request stuck with me, and Nathan encouraged me not to say no. So I started to seriously think back over the past year and a half of teaching, probably for the first time. For those who don't know me, I'm Marika Gillis, and I work as an instructional coach and IB coordinator at Sand Creek International. That is a K-7 school in Harrison School District 2. We'll be adding 8th grade to our school next year. In my role, I work closely with teachers, especially the new ones, to set up their literacy block in the classroom, and I manage the International Baccalaureate program at my school. It's a job I share with a teammate, and together we provide a lot of professional development and facilitate a lot of meetings. And on the very best days, I get to teach children how to read. What I speak about today is my experience working in a school during COVID. There are many other people in this congregation who are also working in schools over this past year. I think about Beth Berkey and John Frederick and Kara Farrell. And I'm sure there are others that I haven't mentioned, and I would encourage all of you to seek out their stories because they might be quite different from mine. While reflecting on what to say today, I was really trying to think about ways to be inspirational and positive, but I decided it was probably more important to just be honest about my experience. And honestly, there wasn't a lot about this past year that was inspirational for me. For me, it has been the longest and most difficult year in education. And if you have ever been a first-year teacher, then you know what it means to say that. So as I've reflected on the last year and a half, there were three feelings that have really risen to the surface and stuck with me over the months. The first is the realizations of the limitations of my impact as a teacher. I've always been proud to be in education, and it's always felt like a job that's made a difference. But this past year, I came to realize the limitations of my impact and began to see more of the real story of our students' lives. Since January, I've been teaching a small group of first graders online for about a half an hour, 4 days a week. While it's really difficult to teach reading to students online, this was most certainly a highlight of all of my days that I got to do that. This reading group was made up of just three little girls. Excuse me. One girl sat at her desk. It was an L-shaped desk in her house, and her dad was working at the other end of that L-shaped desk while she was in class with me. And she was always eating something every single time we would meet together. It's kind of hard to teach somebody how to read when they're eating food. Another little girl would join our team's meeting from a house that was so filled with activity and noise that she became kind of an expert at hitting that mute button the minute that she stopped talking, sometimes even cutting off the words that she would say so that we wouldn't hear the noise that was surrounding her. I could tell that little girl was self-conscious about the noise and amazed at her ability to really focus on me in the midst of all of that chaos that she had at her house. In contrast, I never saw another living soul in the home of the third little girl in my group. But every day, when she would get on, she would have the TV flickering on in the background, and I would have to tell her to turn it off before we would start our lesson. I'm going to call this little girl Anaya. Anaya was filled with self-confidence, and she would always ask me how I was doing, and then she would always tell me something she was looking forward to. She was a talker, and she is that kid in class who always wants to answer every single question, and she's not afraid to read in front of all the other kids. Anaya's also Black. One day I logged onto my meeting, and Anaya was the first one to get on. She immediately asked me if she could go to the bathroom. Now, that's a really strange situation, to have a student on the other side of a screen ask for permission to use the bathroom at their own house, miles away, is kind of odd. So I told her she could, and she dashed out of view. While I waited for the other girls to log on, I could hear Anaya's TV in the background. It was airing the Derek Chauvin trial for the role in the death of George Floyd. I sat there for a minute listening to that, and I wondered what it must be like to be an African-American family watching the progress of that trial, what the outcome of that would mean for her and her family. Here I am, a white teacher on the other side of a computer screen, and I wondered, what can I possibly do for this little girl? My whiteness means that I will never fully understand her reality and what she's up against in this world. I am inadequate to prepare her for her future. In so many ways, teachers were so limited in the ways that they could impact students this past year. Some of these limitations were new, like the screens that were between us, like not being able to prevent a student from eating during a reading lesson. But some of them have always been there, like the sicknesses in the families that we could not heal, and like the reality that hit me that day with Anaya. This pandemic just brought them into more clearer view for me. The second feeling that persisted during this time is one I have dubbed as worker's guilt. Like survivor's guilt, when a person survives a catastrophic event that others have not lived through, I have experienced guilt for having hesitations about working in person at a steady job during a time when people have lost their jobs. As a person who believed that wearing masks and staying home was the best way to keep myself and my loved ones safe, I was initially uncomfortable with the societal pressure to reopen schools and a bit reluctant to return to a place where over 80 other adults gathered every day together to work. I was disappointed when those people who were so supportive of teachers in the spring of 2020 and we were all online learning together became quiet. The conversation around teachers shifted at the beginning of this school year. Nobody wanted to come out and say teachers needed to get over their fears and go back to work, so the conversation became about the schools and how they needed to be open because students need school for their mental well-being and to provide structure and support in their lives. Teachers, just as well as anybody else, recognize that without schools, students do not have as much structure, but also neither does our society. The economy cannot recover when parents cannot go back to work. Parents cannot go back to work if their children cannot go back to school. And children cannot go back to school if teachers weren't willing to risk getting COVID and go back to work. So up creeps the worker's guilt. Being afraid that people would hold it against you if you, a teacher, didn't want to risk your health or the health of your family to go back to work in person does not feel good. And at the same time, feeling fortunate to have a job during a time when others are losing theirs equated to a lot of confusion and guilt for me. It was a tricky bag of emotions to balance, and I'm still wrestling with that. This past year and a half, I heard about the awkwardness of teachers teaching from their bedroom because they live with roommates who were also working from home. I watched as two teachers at my school quit mid-year because the pressure was just too much. I saw groups of students get quarantined. I heard about kids trying to attend class from a hotel room where their very large family had to take turns sleeping in the only two beds that they had. I listened as our principal told us that she was leaving after winter break. And I listened in horror to the news that a shooting at a party had killed members of the family of many of our students. Eventually, I made a conscious decision that I just needed to keep showing up. This is the final feeling that has stuck with me and carried me through the last few months of the school year. The only things I knew how to do were show up, do what I could to keep the people around me and my school community safe, and remember that God was in charge. So that's what I did. Since our school shut down in March of 2020, right up until May 21st, when Jack, my son, had his fifth grade continuation, I did not miss a day of work. Whether it was online or in person, I showed up. I may not have done my work as well as in the past, and I know I messed up a lot of things, but I showed up because others could not show up. Someday, I felt it might be me who wouldn't be able to, and I would need somebody to show up for me. I think that's what we do when we are followers of Jesus. We show up for people, and we do the best we can for others. It has not been a restful year, not for me, not for many of us. Recently, during lunch duty, I looked around the cafeteria and saw a little second grader eating her lunch. I hadn't seen this little girl's face in a while because of the masks, and I noticed that she had her grown-up teeth. The last time I had noticed this student, she still had her baby teeth. It struck me. These kids are still growing, even under their masks. It might not be as obvious to us, but they are, and I think I'm still growing too. It has not been a restful year at all, and I believe that God hasn't been resting either. He has not grown tired or weary, even as we all have. He has been at work in the midst of this, like that little second grader's two front teeth. It might not be as easy to see, for me, the change under the masks, but he's working, and it might not be until the masks are off and time has healed us a bit before we recognize the work he has done. I don't think I see that work yet, so I will use this time to hope in the Lord and renew my strength, and I will try my best to keep showing up. Thank you. Amen.